Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Robin Young, co-host of NPR's Here and Now.
And on behalf of everybody at WBUR, we are so proud to be supporting media members of this fantastic Hub Week. Welcome to the Fenway Forum at Faneuil Hall. We are the hub. We can't help it. We've become the subject of the world's curiosity, so why not take advantage of that with this week? So we're about to bring in our esteemed panel. And I don't think I've ever said that. I mean, I've had a lot of esteemed panels. This is the esteemest. So I'm going to ask, and I'm going to have a little paragraph to introduce each one. We told them in the walkthrough earlier they're going to be coming down the aisle like bridesmaids. So if you could just hold your applause until their whole introduction has been completed, and we'll welcome each one. Our first is president and editor-in-chief of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Huffington Post. Ooh, there's a clue. Author of 14 books. She's been named to Time Magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential people, Forbes most powerful women, Arianna Huffington. The next is a homer. He's ours. He is ours, but we have to share him with the world, whether it's helping mentoring kids in Chicago to become cultural citizens or performing around the world. His discography includes 90 albums, 18 Grammy Award-winning albums. He is artistic. He's also the bad boy in the class. He's been throwing paper, airplanes, Yo-Yo Ma. And by the way, we heard Christina Koh, Shane, and Joe of the Silk Road. Let's have applause for them. We're going to hear them later. How exciting was that? The Silk Road Ensemble. So we'll be hearing more from them. Our next guest, I want to be her best friend. She was the president of the Harvard Lampoon, is now a writer of the Emmy Award-winning show Veep. Her Twitter handle is, oh God, it's Alexis, Alexis Wilkinson. Our next guest is a principal research scientist at MIT, New York Times bestselling author, co-founder of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. His book is a must, The Second Machine Age. It looks at the way digital technologies are changing business, the economy, society. He's always a fantastic interview and guest. Please welcome Andrew McAfee. And our final panelist is still recovering from the rave review that Jonathan Franzen just gave her new book in the New York Times. As she said, you know, he didn't have to review it. He wanted to review it. She has spent the last 30 years researching the psychology of people's relationships with technology, how timely. She's the Abby Rockefeller Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT, founder of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. Her new book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, Sherry Turkle. And finally, to conduct for us really a masterclass. I mean, we have all these great institutions, but frankly, we don't get to go to them. Now we're going to get an 80-minute masterclass. To complete the band, we have Mick Jagger. Oh, wait. He sort of is. He's been described as the most relevant living philosopher, a rock star moralist, according to Newsweek, the most popular professor in the world. His writings on justice, ethics, and democracy have been translated into 27 languages. His legendary courses, the first Harvard course to be made freely available online and on television, viewed by tens of millions of people around the world, and inspired people to really take up the big moral and ethical and philosophical questions. Please, I turn the program over to Professor Michael Sandel.
Thank you. you. Thank you, Robin. Thanks to all of you for coming. What a glorious place for a philosophy class. And what a dazzling panel. Some people think philosophers are people with their head in the clouds. I say philosophy belongs in the city, where people gather, in places like Faneuil Hall, this great civic meeting place in the heart of the city of Boston. It was here that Samuel Adams came to debate American independence. Frederick Douglass came here to argue for the abolition of slavery. Today, we take up the question, with your help, we take up the question of how we can find our way as citizens and as human beings in a world where technology has given us unprecedented powers to change not only nature, but also ourselves. Now, philosophy, I know, can seem a daunting subject. So let's begin with a simple, concrete example. Parking. It isn't easy to find a parking place in Boston or in many American cities. And to deal with this problem, the last couple of years, people have designed an app. One of these was launched in San Francisco a year or two ago called Monkey Parking. The way it works is this. People drive around endlessly in places like San Francisco and Boston and New York City to try to find a parking place on the street, a meter, and it isn't easy. What the app does, if you subscribe to it, is if you have a parking place and you're about to leave it, you can put it up for sale. And if you're looking for a parking place and you really need one, you can bid for someone to vacate his or her spot. You could offer $15 or $20 if you're really pressed. Now, cities are trying to decide what to do about this, whether to permit this app. Let's begin, before I turn to our panel, let's begin by seeing what people here think. Now, on your seats, you have, now, have you practiced with these yet? Red and blue placards. We have, you've discovered them. We have a very high-tech way of gauging your opinion. So let's suppose that you are in charge of the decision. You get to vote on whether the city of Boston should permit or prohibit this parking app that enables people to buy and sell places in public metered spaces. If you would permit this app, raise the blue side of your placard. If you would prohibit it, raise the red side. Wow. So the majority, we can tell by our high-tech tally, would ban this. Why? Should we see what they think? Who here would permit it? Three. Lex, three. And who would ban it?
Can we skip the app? Cut out the middleman?
Well, we know you're rich, okay? You don't have to pull out money on us like that. All right? We got it. I get it.
I'll take it.
Thank you.
All right, Alexis.
That's the mark of a recent college grad when she sees a 20 and thinks that somebody's rich.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're rich, too. Oh, $20, not any money. Okay.
All right. Alexis, the majority of people would vote to ban it. And we'll hear, why you would permit it. Why?
I don't know. I think that the problem of parking, not having enough parking spaces, is the city's problem. And they plan the city the wrong way. So if you want people not to sell their parking spaces, you create more parking spaces so you can collect that money. And if you're not going to do that, then you don't get the money that someone's going to pay for their private parking space. Like, it's the city's problem, and if they really want to reap those benefits, they would just create more parking spaces.
But in the meantime, people are driving around and around looking. In fact, they did a study I read about in a 15-block area of Manhattan, and it turns out, over the course of a year, people drive collectively 366,000 miles just looking for a parking place, which is the distance to the moon. Ariana.
So my first question is, have these people not heard of Uber?
I see.
I mean, the first thing is that increasingly more and more people take Uber or Lyft or whatever rather than driving themselves or doing something which adds stress. The reason why I would permit it is because I permit anything that reduces stress. And one of the most stressful things is looking around for a parking spot, especially if you have a plane to catch or an important meeting or something and you can't park your car and you haven't been smart enough to get an Uber and not take your car in the first place. And so the fact that somebody at that time doesn't need his parking spot as much or prefers to make $20, that's more valuable to him, I don't see why we shouldn't allow it.
It's a mutually advantageous
exactly.
deal.
Yes, because nobody's forcing you to give up
right.
your parking lot.
Right.
And it really, you are making the decision that $10 or $20 or $50 or whatever is right. at that moment in your life more valuable than the parking spot.
It's worth it.
It's worth it.
So why not allow people to do this voluntarily? Sherry?
Well, it kind of commodity. I mean, we live in a city, we live in a community. It kind of treats everything about our public life as a commodity. I think it gets you into thinking about that parking spot as though it's yours in a kind of economy. I mean, I could see that people would just kind of spend the day going to parking spots, the hot ones.
And hoping for an offer.
I mean, I can think of some parking spots right now that, you know, I would just kind of hover around. And, you know, I mean, I just think that it you begin to think of the city as a commodity that you can profit from. I think it gets you in the wrong frame of mind. I'm thinking public transportation. I'm thinking other things.
So parking space squatters, you feel, would arise and abound.
Yeah, I do. Sort of an underground economy of...
Andy?
Yeah, Michael, with all respect, I'm not sure this is a question of philosophy. I think this is a question of economics. I hang around with a lot of economists, and they really like mechanisms to match supply with demand. Parking places are scarce. Let's figure out how to allocate them. I think the discomfort that a lot of us have is that the people participating in this app are selling something that's not theirs. They're sitting on a public piece of road owned and maintained and built by the city of Boston, and they feel like they get to give that up. Now, I'm with Sherry. This could lead to what economists would call perverse incentives. I'm going to squat in a parking space all day until someone meets my, more economists speak, reservation price for giving this up. So that's a problem. The other thing an economist would say is, by all means, let the app happen. Let half the revenue go to the city of Boston to pay for infrastructure or early childhood education or something great.
There is another possible solution, which some have proposed, worried about the thought that this is letting people sell something that isn't really theirs. What about the city of Boston? See, part of the problem, some say, is that if you get a parking meter, if you're lucky enough, it's $1.25 an hour. That's a great deal, but it's priced, to address the economist's point, it's priced way below the demand, at least at certain times of the day. Why not have dynamic pricing, as they call it, of parking places in the city of Boston? They've tried this in San Francisco, where sometimes going to a parking meter, you have to put in for 1 hour $7, if that's what the demand. Would you be in favor of that?
Yes.
What do you think, Yo-Yo?
Well, if I were living in New Hampshire And Boston seems like a very far away place. And I hear about all of these sort of like, almost like tolls that I have to go through in order to come to the city. I might never come to Boston. So I would just think about those people also, while we make it convenient for ourselves to say, sure, I'd like to get my $20 back, so I'm now going to go squat in one of those parking
spaces. But just think of it, you know, who would squat? I mean, only people who don't have a job and therefore really need the $20. I mean, obviously nobody who has a job or is otherwise gainfully employed would say, I'm going to take a day off work and go and squat at the parking spot. So, in fact,
I'm not sure they would. Uber drivers make somewhere between 10 and 15 bucks an hour. If you can squat on a parking space and not even have to drive and make that much money, you'd fill up every space in Boston.
Yeah, but the point is that this is not, it all depends on who desperately needs a parking spot at that time. Well, at least if you are driving, you know for sure you're going to be paid. And given how, because of Andrew's second industrial machine age, there are going to be fewer and fewer jobs, I think being able to sell your parking spot...
I think pinning this on me is a little
entirely
harsh.
Yes. If that book had not been published, we would not have been dealing with this problem. So... people who in real
it's not
need...
Mein Kampf, for God's sake. All right,
but
so...
I'm worried about the moral... I'm worried about what it does to our sense of community. I mean, I lived on a block in Boston where when there was a snowstorm, people who did have jobs and great jobs used to kind of hang out and protect places to park because they knew that the storm was coming, and it was important to keep a parking space because there was going to be wrong side and right side of the, you know, of the street parking, and it led to, you know, fights among neighbors and tremendous bad feeling and, you know, everything bad in a whole neighborhood of Boston.
So you worried that this would erode the sense of community?
Yeah, that we're in this together, that we
by making
we have
everything
to,
a commodity.
That everything about living in the city is a commodity. I'm kind of with Yo-Yo on this. I mean, there's
all
kind
right.
of a...
Ariana,
quick thing. With the greatest respect to Sherry, what Sherry is describing is happening before the app. So there's nothing wrong with the app. I mean, the app isn't going to exacerbate human nature.
Oh, yes,
in the
it
sense.
Does.
In what way? First of all, I hate disagreeing with Sherry because I adore her and admire everything she writes. So.
Now you're going to have to say that every time you disagree with anybody up here. All right.
Apps are multipliers. It's not that all this stuff didn't exist before the app. But what the app does is take a piece of human behavior and kind of freeze it and give it an algorithm and creates kind of multiplier effect.
All right, let's shift to the Uber example, which Ariana raised. Suppose people despair of the parking situation and its moral conundrums in the city of Boston and just resolve instead to take Uber. Now, Uber also uses dynamic pricing, as they call it. They don't like to call it price gouging, they call it price surging. Price surging, which means that a couple of years ago in New York, there was a huge snowstorm. The city was virtually paralyzed. And the price of a ride on Uber went up by 8 times the normal amount. Now, some people said this is price gouging, taking advantage of a disaster or an emergency. Nobody can get around after the snowstorm. Other people said it's a way of bringing supply and demand together. It's giving an incentive to those drivers to go out in these perilous conditions. Let's see what people think about whether it's fair or unfair for Uber after the snowstorm in New York City to charge 8 times the normal price. Raise the blue card if you think it's fair or if it's permissible, morally okay, and the red card if you think it's objectionable.
This is an economically sophisticated audience. Good on you.
All right, a lot of blue are raised. All right, and I should say we have in the balcony, we have, I'm told, a lot of students. Is that right? No? How many in the balcony are students? Let me just hear. All right. So that may have accounted for some sympathy for Uber. What do the panel think? Now here, the dynamic pricing, the majority supports Uber's putting up the fare. Let's see what our panel has to say. How many think that's okay? How many don't? Yo-Yo, you're sitting on the fence a lot.
I'm always on the fence.
All right, but it bothers you a little?
Well, a little, but, you know, again, why does it have to be an Uber question, and why not something that people can resolve on their own without Uber? In other words, you could ask a taxi driver to say, and I've seen that so often already in many cities, there's an emergency, will you take me to such and such a place for more money?
An extra payment.
Or will you share with somebody? That's a human interaction, but you don't have to necessarily, I think, the question is that we're monetizing everything.
Hmm.
And the more you monetize things, the more you actually judge human action by monetary values. And I think not all human values should be monetized.
Says the guy who ripped out a $20 bill on stage earlier.
Yeah, and you took it.
I gave
Except
it back.
You took five.
But
that's pretty good.
It doesn't Alexis, it doesn't bother you.
No, I'm torn because I live in L.A. now and I don't have a car, and so I literally take Uber and Lyft everywhere, and it's been really convenient. But I remember hearing a story about, I think in Australia,
right.
maybe people know about this, there was a mass shooting,
yeah,
and like Uber was surged majorly, so it was people getting like gouged trying to escape like an active shooter.
It was Paris. Oh. When they did that in Australia, they actually made it free for that entire geography.
But no, they learned. They surged first, I thought, and then everybody freaked out and was like, this is ridiculous. I'm trying to flee. Please let me flee. And then they brought it down.
All right. Just to be clear, in Sydney, Australia, there was a hostage taking in a building downtown. And Uber did initially surge its price to four times with a minimum to take an Uber to get out of to escape the downtown area, a minimum of $100 Australian. And then they came under criticism and they changed the policy.
Right.
So what do you think about that?
I think it's
Michael,
just,
in the moment in Australia they realized what was going on, they turned off the surge pricing.
Let's get at the principle. What do you think, Alexis?
I think in principle, I think there just has to be a difference between a state of emergency versus like, oh, it's rainy outside. You know, I understand surge pricing. Like, I definitely, during rush hour or whatever, you know, especially in LA, it's just terrible traffic. I don't know why anybody would want to drive in that. And I understand, okay, I'm going to pay twice as much because this is awful. But I think they're just, as long as Uber and other apps can keep, you know, there's got to be exceptions. And I think states of emergency, violence that people are trying to escape, I think those are exceptions and you should put a little
And there. What is great here is that Uber has recognized that. And this is part also of the moral evolution of Uber, that they've realized that when it is a state of emergency, exactly what Alex is describing, they're going to basically overrule the algorithm. Because the way you are describing it is as though somebody is sitting in an Uber office and decides this is going to be four times as much. That's not what's happening. There is an algorithm that is activated to see how do you bring out more cars. What is the incentive you need to give to drivers to get out on a rainy or snowy day or whatever? And that's what determines the surge pricing. But I completely agree with Alex. As long as humanity can overrule the surge pricing in instances of a real public emergency, then I think bringing out more drivers is in the interest of everybody.
Sherry?
I think that to just take it a little bit of a distance and not just be looking at Uber, but be looking at the whole world of apps in general, that once these apps start to almost become, once we start to treat them almost like public utilities, once they become so integrated into our everyday life, we want them to have some kinds of responsibility. And we want to have something to say about that, what that responsibility is. And I think that's the missing connection, is that, you know, Uber's a company. It can do whatever it wants. But we become so dependent on it. I mean, look at the way we're talking about it. That you want to say, well, it should have some sort of, it should have these sort of humanistic or humanitarian or sort of common sense public responsibility parameters working. But we don't have any mechanism by which we can, you know, make that happen. Well, and I think that's what you want to have happen.
Sure we do. We have not using the app, and if it becomes unpopular enough, it'll fade away. The reason Uber has become a big part of our daily lives is because it works so well, because it satisfies what we learned is a dire need inside cities to get it from point A to point B. And that we monetized that transaction a long, long time ago with taxi cabs, who do a terrible job of accomplishing that goal. Uber comes in and does a much better job. That's why it's so deeply woven into our lives.
But you see people really struggling, really not finding the mechanisms to get Uber to have the employee practices, for example, that people really want them to have.
I think the Australia story indicates that we absolutely
do
have
those
mechanisms.
No, I mean in every aspect of how they treat their employees and the benefits for their employees.
Well, we've been talking about the morality of raising prices in an emergency, and there may not be a big disagreement about the morality of it, but many states have laws prohibiting companies from raising prices in an emergency. Should we rely only on the moral goodwill of companies to do this on their own, or should the law prohibit price gouging in the wake of a hurricane, let's say, or a national emergency? In Massachusetts, it's illegal, for example, to raise the price of gasoline beyond a certain point during a public emergency. Andy, are you in favor of those laws, anti-price gouging laws?
I am, because they violate my sense of fairness, but there are two serious problems with them. One is they're really hard to write well. So would the Uber surge in a snowstorm pass that or not? They can be clumsy instruments. The other one is we know that one outcome of those price gouging laws is in some cases the gas is not going to show up because it's not worth people's time and hassle to get it to the gas station. So it's just not the case that the alternative is everybody has enough gas and doesn't have to pay as much for it. There will be a penalty.
Companies don't always use the technologies that enable them to engage in dynamic pricing. Some years ago, Coca-Cola invented a vending machine that was sensitive to the temperature. So most of the time, it would sell a can of Coke for $2. But if the temperature went above 85 degrees, it was $3.50. Now, that's not a grave moral question, I don't suppose. But what about that, Alexis?
I mean, that's smart. that's very smart. I don't know. I think the question I would have about sort of laws that would prohibit sort of raising those prices is that, like, okay, gasoline is one thing, but water, you know, is like a local convenience store allowed to raise the price of water in a drought? Like, I don't know sort of where that line would be drawn. Like, Coca-Cola, that's a little sneaky and mean to kids who only have $2, but is it morally wrong? No.
They did actually, in the face of public outcry, they did not institute that vending machine. Now, we've been talking about pricing, the ethics of pricing, and the way that apps enable us to discriminate in pricing pretty finely. Let's shift from pricing to privacy, but let's stick with Uber for a while, because Uber has been the subject of controversy on this score as well. When they launch in a new city, they often have a launch party with dignitaries, VIPs from that city, and part of the entertainment, in at least one case, they showed on a big screen in the party a live picture of Manhattan showing all the Uber cars that were then driving around in Manhattan. They call it the God's view. But then they, for the amusement of the participants at the party, they identified 30 well-known people who were riding in Manhattan in Uber cars at that time, That the critics called not the God's view, but the stalker view. And one of the people at the party texted a friend she recognized and said, "I see you're at the corner of Fifth Avenue and 36th. Where are you going?" And he wasn't happy about it. And so here's the question. A lot of social apps require us to give companies a lot of information, data, about ourselves, in this case, where we are and where we want to go. Did the stalker view on Uber, was that an unjust violation of privacy, or was that okay? Let's take a quick vote here. How many find that a violation of privacy that's objectionable? If it's objectionable, raise blue. If it's okay, raise red. All right, the majority, there's a sea of blue, but there are quite a few red.
It's like the electoral map for Massachusetts out there. It's so blue.
All right, let's hear from someone who raised the red placard, who thinks we shouldn't worry so much, we should get over it. Who among those who think it's okay will tell us why? Why is this not a violation of privacy? Over there toward the back. Stand up and tell us your name.
Jessica.
Okay. All right, let me write that down here just a minute. All right, Jessica. Why is it okay?
Simply put, if you sign up for it, you know what you're getting into.
But wait. But the guy at Fifth Avenue and 36th was surprised when he got this text.
Do more research before he signs up and gives his information away.
Uh-huh. So it's on him.
Yes.
He should have known better.
Yes.
Let's have the panel react to what Jessica had to say. Who's bothered by this?
I'm
Who thinks it's
it.
Wrong?
Yeah.
All right, 4 out of 5. Alexis, you're not sure. But all right, let's. What would you say to Jessica?
Well, I think there are two separate things. One is what Uber did to show those 30 people at the party was wrong. Giving our data in terms of Uber knowing where we are at each moment, that's an essential part of the app, and actually it can be an incredible safety measure. Like if something happens, you know immediately where somebody is. So the general giving of that data is not a problem for me. What Uber did that particular instance at that particular party was a problem.
So you think that was wrong?
Yeah.
You think so, Alexis?
The only reason I was sort of hesitant is because I think it's exactly that. I think that instance was wrong, and I don't think there's anything in the terms of service that say, are you okay with Uber just randomly showing your address to a random group of people at any given time? Like, I don't think that's in the terms of service, and maybe I'm wrong.
Well, my guess is buried somewhere on page 38 of the terms and conditions.
Probably, at the bottom.
You know, we will make use of your data in some generic way.
Right. But I think fair use is one thing versus just violations of privacy. And I mean, there's been stories about, you know, what if someone was going to cheat on their wife and their wife was in the room and they saw them on their way driving. Like, you could really mess something up for someone.
So that's something that really should be hidden, you're saying?
No. I mean, you know, I let people do what they want. I just think that there can be real consequences to that. It's not as innocent as just, oh, we're just sharing your data in sort of a to show what the app does. I think using it to identify when something happens, and I, as someone who uses Uber a lot, like if the driver takes a route that I know is the wrong route, and they're, you know, I think they're purposely trying to just make the fare go up, I will tell them, and they will know exactly where the driver wrote, and they'll be like, yeah, you're right, he should have turned right, turned left, and it cost you $2. Here's the $2 back.
But here's my question. Should we just get used to the idea that companies know a whole lot about us? The Uber stalker view reminds me a little bit of an experience my son Adam had. He has a friend who works for DoorDash in San Francisco. And Adam had ordered takeout from a Japanese restaurant using DoorDash. And he was talking on the phone to his friend in San Francisco at DoorDash,
wow,
who said to him, "Don't eat too many of those shumai." He knew what he had ordered. Isn't that creepy, Alexis?
Yes. I don't know. I think...
Would you like someone in San Francisco or in Boston knowing everything that you order when you order takeout?
No, but I think that's not fair use of the data. Like, would I like the next time I go to order my hot wings, you already know what hot wings I like and you pull it up? Yes.
You want the convenience. Sort
of I want the convenience, and I think using it to benefit the consumer is one thing. Using it to, because that's the thing, like, what... Sharing that information with somebody else, it's not going to make them buy what I'm buying. Even profit-wise, what are you trying to do besides creep me out? Like,
ten years ago, most of us, myself included, would have found it profoundly creepy that a stranger could take a picture of me, put it on the internet, and tag me so that the world would know exactly where I was at some place. It's happened 100 times today.
And therefore, what do you conclude from
that? Our notions of privacy are actually very, very fluid. I do think the Uber example is incredibly boneheaded, but our notions of privacy are clearly very fluid.
See, I think our notions of privacy are fluid, but there's kind of a stopping point where we give up something that I think people are starting to feel this is too much. And I think the notion of where we are, who we're talking to, when you get into a taxi, you should feel that where you're going is a private act. I'm very struck by Jessica, who just said, you sign up, you should know what you're getting into. All that person did was get into a car to get from point A to point B. And yet we're somehow getting into the mood where getting into a taxi means that we're making a public statement.
The fact that the world knows you're here?
What?
Are you creeped out by the fact that the world knows you're here?
No, because this is a public event, and I'm expecting that that's a public act. But I think that we have to begin to think again and define some acts as private acts. And when I buy a book, let me give you an example that I think is very relevant to Michael's question. The first time I bought a book, and someone said, say no if you don't want to share this. I thought, what? Say no? I have to opt out of sharing this? No. I mean, I remember the time when you went to the public library and it was sacrosanct, the books that you read. The whole point was that you had mind space where the books that you read and what you were thinking about was precious. And now all of a sudden you have to opt out of having the books you read be widely shared on social media?
Yo-Yo?
Well, one of the things that I'm struck by is that you use the Uber example, algorithms, but people have shared information about one another forever. Gossip. We all, it's just that this technology is taking things to a different scale, but actually, the idea of a village, everybody knows everything, knows everybody's business, is some of that is good because we talk about communities where we used to be able to have unlocked doors because people would look out for one another. Today, we tend to lock our doors because, who knows? And if someone is looking out for you, you might think that they're actually intruding upon your privacy. So I'm just sort of thinking that what you're looking for is, do we have enough sort of a individual or societal moral center that says, beyond this, we shouldn't go?
Right.
Like, for example, what about price surging for doctors? How would that be, and we try and do that with transplants so that there's no, but, there are ethical questions at every single level of society for every action that we make, whether they're on a computer or not. Mm-hmm. So I think it comes back to, a moral center that we can agree on, and I don't know whether at this point
thinking of price surging for the Coke versus price surging for water. Price surging for Coke, okay, but not price surging for water.
What about for baseball games?
Well,
No. You could buy tickets online because people will have bought
No, what, yeah, Yo-Yo is talking about those ticket scalpers outside Fenway who are reselling tickets. I'm sure that's what you were talking about.
Absolutely. No, because I bought tickets for my daughter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, well.
All right, let's.
No, what? Don't look at me.
You're not my daughter. Unless.
Okay.
Okay, Ariana.
You know, first of all, you know, you could have tried this here. There are people outside who couldn't get in here. You could say, hey, you know, how much are you offering for my seat? $100? It's not really worth $100 to sit down to listen to them. Here, I'll take $100. You can take my seat. We should have tried that, actually, next time.
You think we should try that next time?
And I bet the price would be going down steadily over time, too, right? Where you could be auctioning these seats off cheaper and cheaper as time goes by.
All right, I want to stay on the privacy theme, but this time take an example where we clearly are aware. Jessica may know what Uber does with their data, but not everyone may. Take an example. We're now seeing this in the health insurance industry. Health insurance companies, some of them are offering their clients a deal. You know those Fitbits, wearable devices? They measure every step you take, how much you exercise, what you eat, how much you sleep, everything you do that could possibly bear on your health. They say, we'll offer you a deal. We'll give you one of these wearable devices. You send all the data to us, and if it looks good, we'll give you a big discount on your health insurance premium. Now, I asked, how do people feel about this? Conan O'Brien, I put this question to him. Let's see what he had to say.
It would make me far too self-conscious. Would it measure if I was drinking alcohol?
Yes.
Would it measure how much alcohol I was drinking? I want no part of it. I don't want that to be public knowledge.
That's the deal breaker.
Yeah, I can't have that.
But absent that, it'd be all right.
Would it also measure if I was eating children's cereals, like sugar cereals, late at night, and wearing women's underwear? Would it know that?
I don't know.
Well, again, I feel like what I do in my spare time, and there are rumors out there, most of them are not true, I don't want people knowing that information. And no, so I would not feel comfortable.
All right, how many here would be willing to accept that deal? If you would be willing, raise the blue. If you would not be willing, raise the red. Well, what do you think? Pretty evenly divided. The majority would not be willing, but it's pretty closely divided.
Like our country.
What about on our panel? How do people feel about that? Who here would be willing? Andy, Adriana, Alexis, but not Sherry and Yo-Yo. You put up your hand in a flash. You want to save the money. You work out a lot.
This is a complete no-brainer. It's opt-in. We're protected by HIPAA, so the insurance company would get in huge trouble if they release that personalized information. And an outcome of this is probably that we're going to be healthier as a result.
Alexis?
I don't know. I think just generally, like, I don't believe in private health insurance. I think it should be public, and I think that, like, just debating over whether or not we should give somebody health care versus, like, how many steps they take a day is ridiculous. And so, like, assuming that, you know, we're going to have to take private health insurance no matter what, and they're going to be able to, you know, make the price higher because you take not as many steps as you should, then I think the data would be good, just because at least then, I don't know, I see that the health insurance company then maybe could better track the effects of those things on people's health. And they say, okay, we gave them a discount because they walk this many miles a day or whatever, and like later on, are they actually healthier or not? And like, you know, I think that could be just benefit to the public health.
What do you think, Ariana?
The reason why I like that is because the more information we have about the impact our own lifestyle choices have on our health, the better off we all are. Because right now we know that 75% of healthcare costs are because of preventable stress-related diseases. So if we know that there is something we can do to make us healthier, whether it's movement or sleep or what we eat, avoiding that Coca-Cola, even when it's only $2, all that stuff, you know, it's all good. It's going to make us a healthier nation.
But let me ask you this, Ariana.
Is there a book you could point us to that would help us with that?
The question.
Wait. I want to ask Ariana a follow-up question. It sounds wonderful because it draws more attention to healthy, stress-relieving activities. And you can get a discount if you do it well. Suppose the offer gradually devolved into a slightly different version. If you do not wear this device, it's your choice, but if you do not wear this device and send us favorable health data, your health insurance premium will go up by 50%. What about that?
Well, no, that makes no sense at all, because basically it should at least just go back to what it would have been if you had never taken on that device. I think the rest of it is simply punitive, and I wouldn't be in favor of it.
Although, from the health insurance company's point of view, the purpose of the device, apart from giving people encouragement to live in a healthy way, is to differentiate between those who do and those who don't.
Right, but the alternative is not simply to say, okay, now you're going to go back to the great, unwashed, undifferentiated people. They're saying, no, we're going to charge you more than them just because you started something good and then you gave it up. That, to me, seems completely immoral, unacceptable, and the Huffington Post would be completely against it.
Anyone else?
Well, and I hear here John and Linda basically nodding that the Boston Globe would be against it.
I think that we want to have information about how we live and its impact on our health so we can make those connections. And we want to have that information for ourselves. The idea that that information needs to go directly to an insurance company that's going to be using it for pricing and for withholding, that's where I don't think that the link needs to be direct.
But it happens without...
We need to think about using information that we can get for our self-improvement without thinking that, you know, it immediately needs to go to a central organization that somehow is going to use it for its own purposes.
But how is it different than car insurance? Because your insurer knows when you have an accident, if you have an alcohol driving problem.
It's even better now. There are devices your car insurance company will give you that you can put in your car that will tell them not only whether you've had an accident, but how fast you drive, how far you drive, where you drive, when you drive, and how hard you brake. Would you go for that too? You like that?
I actually take Uber everywhere.
Andy.
Let me give a counter argument to Sherry. The way we're going to get smarter about our individual health is through big data. For example, I believe the largest study of cardiac health in history was signed up on the back of the Apple Watch. This is exactly how we're going to get smarter about living longer and healthier lives, via data aggregation.
You look skeptical.
I just worry about, I don't disagree with you, but I also think
smart
that
move,
there's...
Smart move, pal.
Yeah, you talk so much faster than I do, and there's no way I can argue against you. But I think that there's an issue of trust here, that, I've nothing against big data and algorithms. I think they're great. It can help, but how do we know that whoever is collecting all this information is actually going to always use it for good purposes? And that, I think, is something that I'm always worried about, and I hope that we all have the strength to be on the lookout to not be manipulated by any large organizational forces. Yeah.
So. Thank you. Let's...
That's all.
We've been talking about apps and pricing and privacy. One of the most potent developments in new technology, in biotechnology, are various forms of genetic engineering, and now gene editing. It's already possible to do what people for millennia have hoped to do, to choose in advance the sex of your baby, whether to have a boy or a girl. It's now possible to do that. Increasingly, it will become possible to pick and choose the genetic traits of one's children. hair color, eye color, but maybe, not yet, one day, intelligence, athletic ability, musical ability. Now, suppose that were possible. Should genetic technology be used only to repair injury and cure disease, or should it also be used to let us enhance, to improve our children and ourselves, to make us stronger, more handsome, more effective in the world? Let's see now with a show of placards. If you think genetic engineering for enhancement, for improvement, is okay, put up the blue sign. If you think it's not, put up the red sign.
Ooh.
Wow. So people are not very friendly here to genetic engineering for enhancement. There was, some of you may have seen a movie. Some of you may have seen a science fiction movie, Gattaca, that imagines a future where genetic engineering becomes routine. And in one of the scenes in Gattaca, we see someone playing a magnificent piano concerto, complex, beautiful. Did you see this movie, Yo-Yo?
Should I see it?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. And then the camera moves in, and we see that the person playing that concerto so magnificently has, on each hand, six fingers.
Wow.
What? The majority here in Faneuil Hall don't like that use of genetic technology. What's wrong with it, Alexis?
I don't know. I'm actually 100% for it, and I think, like,
you're for it,
right?
So you're
because of
the blue card.
Yeah, I'd be blue in this scenario, and I think because of two reasons. One, I think it's what humans do anyways. Like, we are always selecting the traits of our mates. We are always selecting what we want in children. It's literally what has brought humanity to this point is evolution. It's just been through, you know, having sex with people versus just fiddling around with the DNA or whatever, but it's the exact same thing. And also, there's only so much that genes can do. Like, you can put another finger on this kid, but it doesn't mean he's going to be, you know, Yo-Yo Ma or anybody else. He just could be a guy with an extra finger. Like, nature, and, you know, a fun party trick, whatever. He can whistle really awesome. Nature and nurture are, like, one and the same. Like, how you raise people actually changes their genes. So, like, if you're a terrible parent, you can have six-fingered Billy or whatever, and he still will not be good at playing the piano.
But that is that why you're for it? Because it's not going to work that well?
Well, I think because there's... I think that people's worries that we're going to have these sort of mutant, like, perfect people that came out of a vacuum that can, you know, do all these amazing things are not valid, because they're still going to be raised by the regular five-fingered people. And, you know, that's how it is, you know, and I just think there's only so much genes can do.
I'm just completely red here. I'm completely opposed to it. First of all, if you think of it, the way we choose our mates is not at all. We don't go for the smartest, most handsome.
We don't?
I don't. I never did.
Okay.
The biggest right. love of my life was half my size and twice my age, and you definitely wouldn't look at him again. So I think the truth is that...
Don't you want to hear this story from Ariana?
Please, Ariana, tell us more. It was a great love affair.
No, nobody here can say that that's why you picked your mates or anything else. You know, and I love the messiness of human choices and the fact that Beethoven and Stephen Hawking might have been eliminated if we had genetic engineering because they were not perfect in some kind of laboratory view of perfection. So no, I absolutely hate that genetic engineering stuff. Can we please just put a complete stop to it right now?
So, now, we found an app you don't like, Ariana.
But Ariana brings
also
up the
really scary point.
Go ahead, Andy.
She brings up the really scary point. You said, can we just put a stop to it? Unfortunately, we can't, right? This genie is going to come out of the bottle, and we can put whatever laws in place we want to in the U.S., and we will, and we probably should. People are going to go forum shopping for their perfect children in not too much more time, and there are going to be places that will accommodate them.
But still, it's very different if we have laws that prevent it in a mass way. People do strange things all the time, but that's not what we can avoid.
What about food? Like, are you okay with the fact that, this great Stephen Hawking banana got eliminated and now we only have this one type of banana? Because that's what we're doing already with all of our foods. And we're already eliminating things that might be delicious but are not perfect, and having other delicious things.
I object to food engineering as well, because the point is that it takes us further away from natural food.
I mean, the whole price surging thing comes back in this area as well, that this is going to be a business. And I think that it does matter, even if people are doing it and finding the niche to do it. I think it matters a lot for a country to say this is illegal. And, if you want to do it, it's illegal and you have to go elsewhere and you have to... it matters if things are illegal and you have to really work to do them and it is illegal. I think that this is something where society can say, this is not what we do.
The closest thing to it that we have now, which is different but close to it, is when people go shopping for an egg or a sperm, right? And they go to Ivy League schools like Harvard and Yale. I'm sure many of you here have been asked to participate in this experiment because they think they can improve their chances of having a smart, fabulous child like all the children here. But there are all sorts of other things that go into making a child that, to Alex's point, are not going to be dependent on an Ivy League egg.
What those ads showed was premium egg wanted, and it said from a woman, it specified, at least 5'9", attractive, athletic, with no major medical issues, and with SAT scores 1400 or above.
Where'd you see this at? I'm about 5'10". Where is this at?
And the amount of
The
amount of money being offered? $50,000 for such an egg. Do you think
she's
that should
leaving.
Be? Do you think that should that even be permitted?
I think so. I think that the idea, this person could buy this egg off me or somebody else, and the idea that that person is going to be an exact replica or be any better than anybody else is just false. Like, science doesn't hold that through. You can only do so much with genes, and that's why you have families where, some of them are Ivy League and some of them, are dropouts and some of them do this and some, if it was all genes, they would all be exactly identical. Like, it just doesn't work that way. So you can fiddle around all you want behind the scenes, but there's still going to be all the variety of human life that you see. We're not going to become, that's what I think. I think all these fears come from the idea that, everyone's going to look the same and sound the same. Like, no, if that were true, we would already be there by now because we already kind of self-select for certain traits. But that's the way, mutations and everything else that just happens.
But even though it might be a bad investment as you see it, people should let the free market operate, even in this domain.
Yeah, I think they should be allowed to waste their $50,000 if they want to, because I don't know. I don't think it's not going to have the effects that people, I think it will.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, Alexis, you graduated last year from Harvard.
Yeah, this year.
Did you take my course?
We were going to talk about this. I actually got lotteried out of his course. I wanted to take it.
She's very bitter.
I mean, I am. I have no morals.
It came up backstage repeatedly.
Yeah, I brought it up multiple times. I never learned anything.
this brings me to my point, is the consequences of not taking Professor Sandel's course.
Never mind that.
No, this is very important.
Look what you created, monster.
I tell you.
Monster because with no morals at all.
Because I think all these questions pose a giant argument for ethical and philosophical thinking. It just makes us, pay attention to how we react to things that give us more control and things that actually cause change. And unless we have some kind of way of kind of thinking not just one issue at a time, whether it's Uber or genetic engineering or more apps, we're not going to have enough time ever to make some good decisions. And I think I think the point is that this is a good way to spend time thinking about those things so that when the time to make a decision about an action or a change or whatever, we've already pre-thought what you would do on the Titanic when the dominant thought at that time was women and children first.
This is absolutely correct. This is tremendously important. But let me suggest one bad guideline for thinking through these kinds of really important questions. Our squeamishness, or the ick factor. Michael, is it Leon Cass who talks about the wisdom of repugnance? What a terrible guideline that is. Most Americans were very squeamish about gay marriage not too long ago in this country. It would have been a terrible guideline for deciding if we should allow that or not.
Well, repugnance is a tricky thing. It's true that if we just reason only from our emotional reactions or from an ick factor, then there's a certain kind of mindlessness about that, because opinions change on reflection. But it's interesting, when we've been taking these votes, red and blue, these are initial reactions. These are expressions of moral intuitions that each of us has in reaction to these various scenarios. But what's interesting and I think important is that those moral intuitions, even in some cases a sense of repugnance or disgust, are not the end of moral argument. They're the occasion for it. They're the provocation for it. They're the beginning of a moral argument to see if whether, on reflection, our initial reaction, blue, red, repugnance, affirmation, really can be defended on reflection. And that, in a way, is what we've been doing. I would like to continue doing this in one other aspect of new technology, and that's the arena of smart machines, machines that in some ways can think as well, maybe better than us. Robin mentioned that we put my course, Justice, online as an experiment. And when we did that, one question that arose was, how can you grade all these essays on Aristotle or on John Stuart Mill? And one solution that was proposed, because we don't have enough people to read and grade all of them as we do in the classroom, one suggestion that was proposed was to create an algorithm based on some papers that had already been graded, philosophy papers, and then machine grade the essays on Aristotle and John Stuart Mill. I was skeptical that this would generate well-graded, fairly graded papers. But suppose there were a very good grading app that were invented, would it be possible one day, if we just get the science right, if we improve the algorithm, to create a machine that could fairly grade and evaluate not a paper in math or computer science, but an essay on Dostoevsky or Plato? It's a question I asked Conan O'Brien. Let's see what he had to say.
Quick question, if I may ask.
Yeah.
If all my papers are being graded by an app, do I still have to spend $100,000 a year to go to Harvard?
Fair enough.
What if I
Fair
don't?
Enough.
What if
yep.
they have an app do it, and suddenly my parents aren't paying anything, but I go to Harvard for 40 minutes every day
right.
while I'm growing marijuana in Oregon, and then you're working at a car wash. How do you feel about that?
Well, do you think the education you would get would be as
no.
good?
No, it would not be as good. I think I'm getting... contact with you is much more valuable than anything I'm going to get from an app. And I would not want my children, the two I have and the two that I will someday recognize, I don't want them to ever be graded by an app.
All right, let's put it to our audience. And here, this time, let's restrict the vote to those who are currently students somewhere at whatever level. Of those who are currently students, do you think it's possible and desirable, if the smart grading app is very, very good, to grade your paper on, say, Dostoevsky or Plato by a machine? How many would be comfortable, those who are students here, if you would be comfortable with that, raise the blue sign. And if you would not be, if you think in principle it's not possible, raise the red sign. How many blue? Not too many blue. All right, I want to hear from someone who has a blue sign up. Okay, go ahead.
So I think it might not be possible today for something to accurately be graded in that way. But it's important to prepare ourselves for that future. When we think about it, who grades essays? Like people. And their brains work according to a series of decisions, logic, based on their own personal experiences. One day it will be possible to program a machine to do that. And for efficiency's sake, I welcome that future.
So you would think you could be graded fairly that way?
Of course, of course.
And even if, suppose you were in a poetry class and you were writing a poem. Do you think in principle a machine could tell you whether your poem was a good poem or not, Michael?
Of course. In the same way that a university professor might have learned throughout his life to appreciate a particular stanza of the poem based on what makes it feel beautiful to him. In the same way that a professor can judge that, so can a machine based on inputs and programming. So can a machine make that determination?
Because the inputs and programming will be rule-based. Figure out the rules that govern these judgments.
Exactly.
Hey, I have an idea for a great app.
Yeah.
A parenting app. So you just don't grow up with parents. Just have an app. Because that would be, you could bring up perfect children. It's like you make no mistakes, and you can make a lot of money, and you get a lot of, discretionary time. And just have an app bring up everybody. Don't you think that's a great idea?
I think that when you hand in a paper, you want a conversation with someone. And if the logistics of a large course means you can't have a conversation with a professor, then it should be a peer-reviewed situation where you get another student, another human being, responding to your poem, responding to your thought, and have a human being who understands, who's lived a life, who understands conflict, pain, love, sex, desire, who understands human things, respond to what you've written as a human being as opposed to try to formalize all this. So I think mm-hmm. that we sort of devalue ourselves when we don't think imaginatively of ways to do this that involve people.
Andy, and then Ariane.
I actually was a professor at Harvard for 10 years, and some semesters I'd have about 180 students, and it was a final exam-based course. Big part of the grade came from the final exam. Students up there, if you think that if you're in that kind of course and your professors are spending an hour per exam grading them, I have hard news for you. If you think that they are grading the 100th exam with the same attention that they paid to the first, I have really hard news for you. And if you think that if you gave them the exact same exam 5 years in a row and they would give you the same grade on it, I have really hard news for you. So, Michael, with your assumption, with this grading app as good as a professor on any subject, let me assure the students in this room, if you want to be evaluated fairly and objectively, you desperately want that app.
Who wants that?
Yeah, but excuse me.
I don't want that.
But shouldn't that be the job of the teacher to actually not have a decline in attention by the 100th student?
Yes, it should.
I rest my case.
My case is whether or not it should, it doesn't happen, it's not going to happen.
Well, wait a minute. But that's like violating the Hippocratic Oath for a doctor. Like, if I'm a physician and I see 50 patients and the 50th patient is going to get not my services, what am I doing being a physician?
Wait, do you think today's physicians are... Do you think today's physicians are totally consistent in their diagnoses?
Wait, no, I'm saying nobody's perfect, but we better aim for something higher than accepting a low
result. Something higher is a piece of technology. We should go that way if we want good outcomes.
Excuse me. I just have to say something because I actually feel very strongly about this. I'm on the fence with a lot of things, but.
No longer.
No longer. I'm stepping out. Okay? This is it. All right. Now, I'll just give you... I'll talk about something I know just a little bit about, which is when you have a kid, anybody, play one note, that can be replicated by anybody else. But you ask that same kid or person, adult, to make the second note happen, the way you actually join the first note to the second depends on the physical mechanism, the neuromuscular structure of the person, and what they want to hear inside. That path from one note to the next is going to be different for every single human being on this planet. The reason we have conversations with people is because you don't know where the conversation's going. If you have an app, I don't care how big the data, how great your algorithms are, it's finite. The idea of the human spirit who can actually get to something that is beyond the finite is part of every human being. And we want to look for that in every student. And we want to demand that every teacher pays attention to every single child in this classroom.
Ariana.
I really mean that.
All right, Ariana.
My God, you're saying you were a professor at Harvard for 10 years? And that's supposed to be like the great institution and MIT, whatever. That if that's not happening there, what are we, you know... Then are we just talking baloney all the time?
Absolutely.
No. I need to come back on that a little bit.
All right,
quickly. It's ringing language. It's lovely language.
It's more than language. This is content.
So let me give you content. Let me give you content. There is a famous study done looking at the parole decisions made by judges in Israel for a period of time. This is a tremendously important decision. These were extremely highly trained, dedicated people. They found out the single biggest predictor of whether or not the person would get parole was what time of day the judge saw the case. If it was first thing in the morning when he had his cup of coffee and he was alert, chances were good. When his blood sugar went down, there was no chance the person was going to get parole. What you say is lovely, except when we look at reality, it doesn't go that way. And when you have objective ways to make these evaluations, we should go with the objective ways if we want the right people to get out of prison and not the wrong people.
Okay. I would like to say that hooray for other ways of trying to find the truth. Okay? So and that's fabulous. But do not leave all the choice to someone that's non-human. Humans are incredibly imperfect. What we make with humans also are imperfect. Do you want to be condemned by a machine, or do you prefer that a jury of 12 people make their decision? And I just want to say that juries can change their minds. Would a machine change a mind?
I must say, I absolutely, completely agree with Yogi. I think that's an incredibly important point, because that's what ultimately distinguishes machines from human beings. There is something in human beings, however flawed, whether you want to call it a soul, whether you want to call it spirit, whether you want to call it inner wisdom, There is something that the machine has never had, will never have. And so for us to leave any kind of important decision, whether it's the grading of a philosophy or poetry paper, or the paroling of a convict, or the choosing of a mate, or any of these things to a machine is deeply troubling for me.
Wait, I think we should even though we know that the wrong people are going to, the wrong criminals are going to be back out on the street.
I want
you comfortable with that outcome?
The point is that why do we know what machines will choose and how machines will actually identify with the deeper parts of what it is to be human and touch
it's
into
not
those
about
parts
the deeper
to make
power
a decision.
Of being human. It's about who's going to commit a crime when they go back out on the
but
street.
I want to go
right.
to an
the
example.
Research is clear on
I want those. To shift to a different example. I want to pick up on a machine to choose us the perfect mate. There are dating apps out there already. Suppose, now, Netflix, if you tell them enough about your tastes in movies and which movies you've liked and which you've disliked, they will predict what new movies you will like, ones you haven't seen. They've got a very good algorithm. Suppose a dating app became so refined and sophisticated that it could become, in effect, a marriage prediction machine, could give you a very short list of the best mates for you. Whose advice would you trust more, the advice of the dating app, or, well, this geared to the students, or the advice of your parents? Now, I put this question to someone we'll hear from now about whether he would want his children to use the dating app. And hear what Pedro Martinez had to say.
Best prepared than a human being to tell you how a human being is going to feel. Hmm. I think you need to have a heart. You need to have a body. You need to have a soul. You need to have a spiritual beliefs that will lead you to all those things. Computers, chips, apps, everything is built by men. And you're basically relying on someone you don't know, someone that's absolutely brilliant, yes, but it's not like you. No. You're unique. You're someone that cannot be duplicated. If I see my kids running into that, I did not do the proper job I should have done.
All right, let's just take a quick vote on the panel. The dating app, would you trust it? Well, maybe we'll put it to you, Alexis.
No.
Would you trust this
app? My mom's
going
to see this.
Would you trust the advice of this app or your parents' advice more?
I don't know. I'm torn. I'm really torn. My mom is going to watch this, and she's going to, oh, I'm sorry.
Should I cover your face? Is that going to help?
that's hard, because I don't know, I think the trouble is that sometimes, like, who you think you are, who your parents think you are, and what some computer thinks you are three totally separate people. And I think you see that, you know, when you have asked people to fill out surveys about themselves and then you ask their friends, oh, are they actually like this? You get totally wildly answered. Like, no, they're not outgoing. They're shy. They're not this. They're that. And so it's which one of those three people are actually you? I don't know. Who's to say? And so I don't know. I think you'll get decent answers from both of them, but, you know, only there's only one person, I guess. So I don't know which one would be more likely.
Rihanna?
Well, I think, first of all, there is no such thing as a perfect mate. Sorry to break it to you. And by that, I mean that there are multiple people with whom you could spend the rest of your life happily with. There isn't just one soulmate. I'm sorry, is that news to Harvard students? And also, there is absolutely nobody who is going to be perfect. Whoever finds them, the app, the parent, etc., at least if the parent helps find them, you can blame the parent. You can hardly blame the app.
All right. I want to, I also put this question vis-a-vis his kids to Conan O'Brien. Here's what he said.
I don't think they should rely on either the app or their father. I think they should go out in the world, and I think the greatest things happen in life when you're at the supermarket and you're reaching for that toilet paper and another hand reaches in for that toilet paper and your thumbs touch. I've done this many times. This is how I meet women. They're always in the toilet aisle. Point being, I think accident, fate, the hand of God, that's what I rely on. I don't mean God in any specific religious way.
I understand.
I mean the God that's on the money, you know.
But does this mean there's a limit to what smart machines can do in principle?
I think there is. I think there's a limit to what machines can do. I think accident, happenstance, things often go wrong to go right. A perfect example in my profession is my best moments are all accidents. If right now your chair were to suddenly break
right
here on camera, and I'm hoping it does, and you're injured, but not badly, but badly enough that it's kind of funny, that's a great moment. You don't want to correct for that. So correcting for every single possible mistake and having a machine do it is going to remove the humanity from our human experience, in my opinion.
So accident and imperfection, these are essential to comedy, and would you say also to our humanity?
Yes, yeah, definitely. I think, how many people have looked at their parents and said, why did these two get together? These two don't belong together.
Yeah.
But then you realize that you're the product of their coming together. And in my case, that changed history.
All right. It's a funny response, but it also touches on a philosophical thread that's been running through our discussions of apps and genetic engineering and smart machines. The role, Conan spoke about the role of accident and happenstance and imperfection. And Yo-Yo, you were just speaking about that very powerfully.
I know a lot about imperfection.
And so in some ways, this connects many of the discussions and debates we've been having. I would like to make a closing observation, try to knit this discussion together. But before I do, I want to thank a truly stellar panel, Sherry, Andy, Alexis, Yo-Yo, and Ariana. And before making a closing observation, I also want to recognize and thank on behalf of all of us one person, the heart and soul of Hub Week, Linda Pizzuti Henry.
Yay, Linda!
And for those in the control room, we're going to jump to the, when I let you know, we're going to jump to the last video clip. So how to try to bring this remarkable, sprawling, irreverent, funny sometimes, but also wise discussion to a close? Well, I think if you listen to the discussions that we've had, it's clear that we begin with these eye-catching technologies and apps. But the debates we have really are not about the technology in the end. They're ultimately about us, about how we should understand and negotiate our relations with one another and with the world that we inhabit. And there's a tension here between two ways of understanding our relation to the world. Most of the time, in our jobs, in our careers, in our professions as students, we aspire to mastery and control, to try to extend our ability to control our lives and events as fully as we possibly can. And yet there are moments, when we notice that the project of mastery and dominion over nature and our children, our families, and ourselves comes up short. In those moments, we care about another set of human ambitions to do with wonder and appreciation, sometimes reverence, even awe. And so here's the question that I think has run through everything we've debated here. In an age of absent genetic engineering and smart machines, could it be that our drive to mastery, sometimes at least, begins to eclipse or to displace our capacity for wonder, for beholding the world rather than simply aspiring to mold the world? Perhaps our humanity today, given our vast technological powers, perhaps our humanity requires that we at least sometimes rein in that impulse of mastery and control, that so as to protect and nurture our capacity to behold the world, to take it in. I want to share with you this idea of beholding the world, of being open to the world that is, as it is given. It's not easy to articulate, but I want to share with you an eloquent expression of this stance of beholding, of wonder and awe, of openness to the world as it is given. And it comes not from a professional philosopher or from a theologian, but from a Hall of Fame pitcher. I asked Pedro whether he worried that young people are spending too much time glued to cell phones and screens and digital devices. Listen to what he said.
I think we miss out. Mm-hmm. I think we miss out by not realizing what a good moment is, what a beautiful moment is. Mm-hmm. When you see a lightning from far away, and then you see a rainbow, if you don't stop to look at those things because you're too busy looking at yourself, I think you miss out, because I think it's beautiful. I think nature is beautiful. I think the rain is beautiful. I think seeing a clean river with a lot of life in it is beautiful. I think looking at the stars and the way the universe is extraordinary. I think, seeing a shooting star is something that you must see. You must live. You must experience. You have to be there. I'm not a big fan of sleeping because I want to see everything. I just want to see. I just want to experience. I don't want my life to just continue on and let the time, see me disappear without me seeing what the time has to offer.
Wow. Science and technology can do wondrous things. But one of the things they can't do is tell us how they should be used. That is up to us. That is our responsibility as human beings and as democratic citizens. And in order to discharge that responsibility, we need, more often than we do these days, to step back, argue together, reason together about some big philosophical questions, including what makes for a good life, including the question, how do we want to live together? Tonight, in this great civic gathering place in the heart of Boston, you and this remarkable panel have offered a glimpse of what that kind of reasoned, reflective public discourse can be. And for that, I want to thank you all very much.
Ariana Huffington. Alexis Wilkinson. Andrew McAfee. Sherry Turkle. And Professor Michael Sandel. We've all just gone to Harvard, but I feel like a little like we've gone to church. So I want to thank everyone again. What do you say? Raise a placard if you think we should do this again someday. Any color. Any color. Wouldn't you do anything to have this gathering on more than one occasion just to talk about these big questions? I don't want to talk about them on Twitter. I want to talk about them in person. We have some music to reflect on all of this. And I had a chance to have an audience of one with Yo-Yo Ma once. And it's a pretty stunning thing. Talk about being taken to church. But we're going to hear him in his Silk Road Ensemble.
So I'd like to reintroduce my incredible colleagues here. Christina Pato on the pipes, Shane Shanahan on drums, Ko Mizaki on the shakuhachi, the bamboo flute, and Joe Gramley in percussion. Thank you, Robin. So, referring to some of the content that we experienced just now, I'd like to play with my friends here on stage two songs. The first one actually is a Catalan song. It's folk song called Song of the Birds. And it's known in Catalonia as a song for freedom. And I think, given what we were talking about, I think freedom obviously has many, many meanings. But for me, the freedom to think and to imagine before doing, I think, is paramount. And then, to bring the evening to a close, Amuniras, which is a song of celebration in Galicia in northwest Spain.